No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-628-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIO and the number 1. Maria's not with us tonight, but we have a very special guest in honor of Black History Month. First, though, I'd like to do a shout out. We have 4 new co-sponsors of our bill to make the District of Columbia a state, the 51st state. And so I'd like to shout out to Congresswoman Doris Matsui, a Democrat from California's 6th district. Mike Thompson, also a Democrat from California's 5th district. Ann Custer, Democrat from New Hampshire's 2nd. And Joseph P. Kennedy III, a Democrat from Massachusetts 4th. You might remember that he gave the response to the State of the Union speech last week. So thank you to those 4 members of Congress for supporting our bill and bringing us up to 146 co-sponsors, which is the most that we've ever had. As promised, I'm going to bring on our special guest. His name is Chuck Hicks. He is the founder and director of DC Black History, the DC Black History Celebration Committee, which celebrates Black history year-round. He's a community activist focusing on issues that directly affect the community. Chuck has served on several Martin Luther King Jr. committees, providing guidance, leadership, and support. His work includes serving on the executive committee of the Martin Luther King Jr. DC Support Group and the Martin Luther King Scott Jr. Scholarship Award Committee. Hicks is also, or Chuck rather, is also the co-chair of the DC Host Committee for the dedication of the Martin Luther King Memorial, which I was proud to work with him on. He also co-chairs the DC Host Committee for the opening of the new National Museum of African American History and Culture, a wonderful place that everybody should visit. Chuck is also a member of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and we're just so thrilled to have him with us tonight. In Washington, D.C., we call this man Mr. Black History. Are you with us, Chuck?
I am. Thank you.
Well, yeah, thanks so much for being on the show. And let's start right at the top, Chuck. Why is it important that we have a Black History Month, a month dedicated to Black history in America? I know why I think it's important. You tell me why you think it's important.
Well, I think it's important for a number of reasons. I think it's important that we realize that there's a time when we need to recognize some special contributions and things that African Americans have done, not only for African Americans, but for other races and cultures in this country. I think it becomes important that we have that Black History Month until we can make it a Black History every day, when every day becomes Black History for everybody. But until then, I think it becomes important for us to zero in on a month as well as spend time throughout the year on special occasion or setting four special events to remind people of the contributions of African Americans in this country, in the city, and in the world. And in addition to that, reminding people of the support and the things that African Americans have done with other Americans in this country. Black history does not stand alone by itself. That part of Black history has also been some of the things that our white and Native American and people of color brothers have done to support us, to make Black history a possibility.
Well, you know, yes, I mean, I agree with all that. And I must tell you that I'm amazed since I live in Washington, D.C., and we have a lot of Black history in Washington. I'm amazed at some of the things that I didn't learn when I was in school. Many contributions from African Americans. You know, we have the African American Civil War Museum, for example, here in Washington. And we don't talk much about the contribution that African Americans made during the Civil War, or we didn't when I was in college. Now, of course, we've had movies and other things that show some of the contributions they've made. But
and
can you tell me?
To touch the surface. I mean, when I grew up, we didn't talk about many of the contributions. Of course, I grew up in a small southern town. But I think throughout the country for years, many people did not talk about much about contributions that African Americans made. There were a few people that they pointed out, and that was as much history as you had. But I think with the growth of all kinds of information explosion and the fact that people now vote, the fact that now people can go to all kinds of institutions, and now the fact that people can do research, people can trace their family history, people can go in and understand what our neighborhood was like before, what it was like 100 years ago, and figure out that Blacks used to live in Georgetown. It was called Black Georgetown before it became regular Georgetown. So all those kinds of opportunities are now breaking forth. There is indeed still so much to learn and so much to educate our children and ourselves about.
Well, let me ask you about one of those things, and that's the new African-American Museum of History and Culture. I've been there, and it's an amazing place, and I have to go back at least a dozen times because, as you said, there's so much there, you can't even take it all in. But let's talk about that for a minute because I know you were involved in that, and it's just an amazing place. Tell us your impression of the place.
I think it's an absolutely amazing place. I think it is an icebreaker for lots of people. I think, of course, that they've been successful. They've had 3 million people visit it in the first year. I think that there are people who want to go. They want to see it. And they've been able to collect 30,000 artifacts. And I think they only have about 3,000 or 4,000 out on display. But one of the things that we need to know that the museum advocates is that the museum is a advocate for encouraging communities, states, local towns to create small museums so that your story and your life can be told. Everybody's story can't be in the National Museum. Those are some major breakthrough points. But if you live in Winston, North Carolina, then maybe, just maybe, there ought to be a group of people putting together a history of Blacks in Winston, North Carolina, that the people in that town, in that state, can learn about the contributions that people, their great-great-grandparents and grandparents and children will do and have done in that state. And so the museum is a national museum, but it encourages people from all different levels to build their own museums, you know, to be a part of their own museums. You can't just rely on the National Museum to learn all the contributions that African Americans have made. That it becomes mandatory and important that people, states, and communities do their own, create their own museums. And even if working through a library where you have exhibits and things that throughout the year, that you can talk about important things that happen in that town or in that county that Blacks have been a part of. And so the museum is a wonderful place to get a wide view of the many contributions of our African Americans. But that museum is also encouraging everybody, every state, every county, every African American and communities have their own stories. It becomes important that people tell their stories in their communities so that their kids and their great-grandchildren and other people will know the contributions of people in that town, in that community, so there's an identity there. You know, you can see Joe Lewis. But that's one thing. But to be able to think about a boxer in your hometown who was successful and encouraged young kids to go to the YMCA or the YWCA, and that he helped to get them to taught them how to box and recreation, but he also encouraged them to go off to school. Those becomes important contributions that every town, every city, every community, every church can make.
Well, that's absolutely true, and I think that we need to know where we came from, right, to know where we're going. And
absolutely.
Certainly, yeah, and certainly there's so many stories out there. And like I said before, I've been amazed at some of them. You know, I always was amazed at the Amistad story that I never knew anything. This was a great thing in American history that involved a former president and the whole country and these slaves that came from the Caribbean. And I never knew about that story. You know, it was just amazing to me.
There are so many stories out here that we have never heard of. And what's interesting sometimes is that when you think you know a story about somebody, you only know a piece of the story about that person. That when you think about Frederick Douglass, and many people, well, he was a slave, and he ran away, and he freed himself, and he taught himself to read and write. But there was so much more to Frederick Douglass. He was an ambassador to Haiti. He was the first juryman for the District of Columbia. He was a self-taught violinist. He was a publisher. You know, he went to Ireland and fought and stood up for the rights of poor whites in Ireland. And so there are all these things that you think you know about somebody, but there's so much more about them and what they've done in the community. Of course, for those who don't know, he was an advocate for the suffrage movement. And so there's so many things that you hear a piece of that are happening in this country that you've learned. But there's so much more to learn about that individual, about an environment. You know, the fact that when we look at the war and the civil rights movement, well, for many people, if they go back and look at World War II and the role of African Americans in World War II, then you will get to understand that the real civil rights movement started when those black men came back from Europe and had fought for this country and for other countries and found out that they couldn't eat in certain places, they couldn't even stay in certain places, they couldn't get decent jobs, and so they began to protest. And lots of people don't know that story, but that story precedes the SNCCs and the NAACPs and the Deacons and CORE. There's a whole group of people who laid a foundation for Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King and Stokely Carmichael. A whole lot of black soldiers who were nameless but came back and took a stand in this country.
Yeah, and that's an important thing for us to know. And unfortunately, I think we've lost a lot of that with our children. I don't know why that is, but, you know,
well,
it seems,
you know,
sometimes
we get comfortable. Senator, one of the things that I sometimes think about when I think about the Civil Rights Movement, and that it was a joint effort with blacks and whites and people of color and everybody to change this country. And I think the thing that we forgot, or we let our guard down, we got comfortable. We thought that, well, if we get the Voting Rights Act change and public accommodation, and people will say, okay, we can do this. Little did we know that there was a group of people out here planning to know this is not going to happen. And so we got comfortable thinking that certain things were going to happen, particularly when we started letting people get credit cards and they could go into stores at JCPenney's or Woolworth or Macy's and shop. and all those sort of things. And we got comfortable and perhaps presumed that the movement was complete, and it was not complete. And before we know it, they've turned around and they've started voter fraud. They started doing all kinds of things to discrimination to women, to all different groups. And so this struggle that we thought was complete, and so we didn't even, many of us didn't even want to bother to share the struggle from whence we came with our children. We just say, okay, things are better now. And before you know it, they're not better. And before we know it, we've not shared the history that we know that we should have known, we should have shared.
Yep. And we know that the cost of freedom is ever vigilance. You know, you always have to know that stuff. And you know, that's absolutely true. And one thing that I try to tell my kids, which I don't think they really understand, is that this is not ancient history either. I remember going to Louisiana with my dad when I was 8 years old and seeing colored and white drinking fountains and going to restaurants. I remember stopping at a restaurant that said members only. And I said to my father, it's members only. And he said, we're members. And you know, it never dawned on me that we were members because we were white. And all white people were members, you know?
Right.
And it wasn't until I grew up that I realized, you know, at first I thought, hey, how cool is this guy? He belongs to a club in Louisiana. But then later I realized, you know, there were a lot of restaurants that said members only, and it was a way to discriminate.
Right.
And, you know, it's not ancient history. And it is, unfortunately, right now we see it repeating itself, right? We see this stuff going on. And it's certainly our problem in Washington with statehood, is that we're still struggling to get our equal rights in the District of Columbia.
Oh, absolutely.
Something you're very much involved in. Can you tell us a little bit about Dr. King? Something we don't know. First of all, you just taught me something about Frederick Douglass. I love Frederick Douglass, but I never knew he played the violin.
He taught his sons and his grandchildren to play the violin. And then, of course, he loved art. If you go to the Museum of American History, a Museum of Art, they got document stuff about all his art. And then at the Frederick Douglass House, they got a whole list of artworks and music that he liked, classical music and stuff. And, of course, Martin Luther King was an interesting individual because I think Dr. King was more spiritual in a lot of ways. I think when he got started, he was a gifted young kid, and he finished college by the time he was 17 or 18 and went off to divinity school. But I think in all of that, I think Dr. King found himself being spiritually led. And lots of what he did, there was a saying that King used to say, it is always the right time to do that which is right. It is always the right time to do what is right.
Well, you know, there are many reasons that I admire Dr. King, but that, Chuck, is the main reason. You know, after I read Letter from a Birmingham. Yes. And once I read Letter from a Birmingham Jail and realized that God was at the center of everything this man did, and he was faithful.
Which is interesting because when you look at Mandela and his movement, Mandela, both of them studied under Gandhi, but Mandela, I think, looked at a lot of what he was doing as a political move. That's why he did not, when he took over as president, he said, we will forgive and we will work together. It was if he had tried to take over white South Africa and make them pay for that, it would have killed South Africa altogether. And so for him, it was a strategic move. For King, when he went into the war in Vietnam, and people thought he had deserted black people thought he had deserted them because they were still fighting for what we call our civil rights, and all of a sudden he's our leader and he's dropped us to go fight into a war that we saw as a white man's war, and for many of us who were African Americans, we saw the army as a place and opportunity where we could join the Army, we could stay in 4 years, we got a check, we come out, we could go to school, we got the VA, we could go to school, maybe buy a house. So why is this man, the one avenue that we have, why is he coming out against the Army, you know, and the military, when that's an avenue for us? And so here he is fighting about the war in Vietnam. But Dr. King was spirit, had moved, had grown just proficiently into an understanding that the fight for human dignity included not just African Americans, but it included all people, and that the war that he was about, he was taking out against, was because it was wrong not only for white people to be killed, but for black people to be killed. And as he grew, he began to look at poverty. And poverty was an instrument that Dr. King saw as affecting everybody. And so when he came to D.C. with the Poor People's Campaign, it wasn't about poor black people. It was about poor people in this country who needed health care, who needed food, who needed economic justice. And so by that time, of course, he was at his lowest level of support from African Americans. And one of the reasons he went to Memphis, and he was in Memphis with the union in Aspen, in Memphis was Aspen, which I'm a part of. And so Aspen, the garbage collectors had gone in, and the quick history is that, of course, garbage men were picking up trash, and it started to rain, and he didn't have a place. Two of them didn't have a place to. They couldn't go back and to the garage and rest in there, get out of the rain. So they sat in this garbage truck, and somehow it accidentally came on and crushed them. And so there was a big protest, and eventually it kept going back and forth. And there, some people asked King to come. And King was undecided, but then the pressure was that King had turned his back on black people. And so he went down to lead a protest, and it didn't go well the first time. And so they asked him not to go back, but the people were saying that King had turned his back on black people, and that here they were, garbage men, trying to get a decent wage, and he wasn't there. And they also were saying that he had outgrown black people or poor people because he no longer stayed in people. During the civil rights movement initially, King stayed in people's houses as the many civil rights leaders. They didn't stay in hotels. They stayed with the minister from a church or somebody who had a decent house, and that's where they stayed. And so King decided that he was going back to Memphis, and that he was to support the garbage collectors, and that he was going to stay in the Lorraine Motel, which was a black hotel, motel. It wasn't all of that, but it was a black hotel, motel, and that's where he went. And so even at that point, his people begged him. He was not supposed to go that night to speak. And they came back and got him and said, the people want to hear you. And some of his advisors say, no, you need to stay here, rest up, so you'll be able to leave this march. And so he said, no, he was going to go. And that's where he gave that famous speech. I may not get there when you know, we all want a life of longevity, but we almost die. We might not get there together, but we will get to the promised land. And so he gave that speech, and I guess it must have been something he saw coming. And then when he went back the next day he was killed. And only then did King's popularity begin to rise again. And he was a big savior, you know, for everybody, black, white, everybody. But at one point, he was at his low, particularly with African Americans and people of color, because we saw him as somebody who had turned his back on our cause. But King saw our cause and what he was doing as a bigger cause involving everybody. He had grown to that level that he could see that black people need to have decent jobs, that black people, more black people were being killed in Vietnam proportionally than white people. So he saw all these things.
Well, it's amazing.
So even with Douglas, you know, when President Douglas became Ambassador Haiti and different other kinds of movements he was involved in, he wasn't always the popular person. He didn't always get along with other black politicians and black leaders. You know, that he had trials and tribulations to face as a leader. And Malcolm had the same kinds of issues to face. That one by one, each leader, Mandela, all of them had challenges, but they stayed the course.
Yeah,
when they
I
were
mean,
popular and when they weren't popular, but they stood for what they believed in that was right. And as King said, it's always the right time to do the right thing, even
well,
in
you
times
know,
of trouble.
Well, you know, some of the amazing thing for me about Dr. King is, first, I don't think many of us remember that he was only 39 years old when he was murdered. And he changed the world. This should be a message to all young people that you can change the world. This man changed the world. And certainly the things that you just said, Chuck, about him opening up to all people was part of the reason that all people honor him. You know,
well,
it's,
you know,
not,
and one of the things,
it's not just a black thing.
Senator, is I don't think people realize how much he meant to the world until he was killed.
Yep.
People all over the world began to realize what a force he was. And back to the black community, we began to realize what a force he was. You know,
well,
the
you
people
know,
who
and,
were
and,
involved in the war in Vietnam began to realize what a force he was. People all over the world began to realize that this was a man about peace, about spirituality, not politicality, but spirituality, that he believed that we could change the world by doing the right thing, by having the right kind of heart.
Right.
You know,
well,
and
you
then
know,
with that does not come with that must come struggle.
Yes.
You know,
and, you know.
You know, he and Douglas and Malcolm and Mandela, all of them believed in struggle.
Right.
You know,
well,
different methods, but they all believed none of it was easy. None of them got it on a silver platter.
Right. And you know, Douglas is famous for saying that, right? You're not,
yes.
If you're not struggling, you're not making progress.
Yeah.
And you know what? I've got to tell you, I remember from the Martin Luther King dedication that we were all involved in. It was a very, very moving thing. I got to be an ambassador one day for people coming to the memorial, and I saw people that went on freedom rides together who hadn't seen each other since those rides, that just break down when they saw a statue. And I remember John Lewis saying that his parents begged him not to associate with Martin Luther King. They said he's a troublemaker. He's going to get you into trouble. He's, you know, stay away from him. So, you know, that's really amazing. And I think you're absolutely right, Chuck. People just don't know the whole story. And the more you find out about this man, the more you respect him.
You know, I'm just at all because none of these leaders had it easy. They always had conflict within themselves, within their communities, outside of their communities. You know, King was fighting with SNCC. King was fighting with CORE. You know, all different groups. The people in Chicago, the big ministers in Chicago, the National Baptist Convention, which is the largest, biggest convention, all did not support King. He was part of the progressive movement. And so none of our leaders, you know, have had an easy time, which, in my mind, says that those of us who are fighting for statehood, that this is not an easy battle, this is not an easy road, because there are obstacles, there are people who don't want us to have what's rightfully ours. And as long as they can throw us the crumbs, as long as they can say, well, you can elect a city council, you can elect a mayor, you can elect judges, you know, they'd be satisfied. But that's not enough. And until we can come together and realize that there is a struggle that we have to be a part of, and that this struggle is not over, and it won't be over until we can receive full citizenship. And the only way we can do that is by teaching each other, each one teach one. And every time the government closes down and we might be affected, that's a reason to have statehood.
Right.
Every time they can decide whether or not we can have a needle exchange program to cut out the passing of AIDS from people who are affected because of drugs, and they won't let us use our money to buy for the needle exchange program. That's That's the reason to have statehood. The fact that this city, the government, federal government, can tell you if you elect certain people, we'll take your government, we'll take your rights away from you. Mm-hmm. That's the reason to have statehood, so that we have the same rights and privileges as every other state, so that we can go in and vote yes and no on topics that affect us.
That's right.
Until we come together, until we start to realize that being in D.C. means more than being able to go to restaurants and go to good theater. But there's some legislation that becomes important in terms of how we live our lives, how our children, our great-grandchildren, our children after us will live their lives, and who will be able to make the decisions for them.
Well, yeah. And that's important, right, that we don't pass this injustice on to our children. And
no,
talk for a minute. Okay, go ahead.
No, we have to start. We have to make a stand. And, you know, anybody who begins, even the American Revolution, when they started off, they struggled for years before they could get enough people to sign the Declaration. Mm-hmm. Everybody in this country during the American Revolution, one for leaving England,
right?
Europe. No. There was a minority of people. The British Crown had more people. They didn't know how to fight on this land, this territory. But they would, and the people here were saying, you know, you can't do this. We need representation. You're taking our money and sending it back, and we don't have a say about it. But that did not happen overnight. And so people cannot get discouraged. You know, we have to come together and continue to march together.
Well, and if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it, are you not, Chuck?
Oh,
I mean, I see the people now rewriting history. I see people up there saying terrible things, and people believe that they don't know the facts, so they believe it's true. This is a problem with DC statehood too, is that we're asking for our equal rights, and people think we're asking for something special, and we're really not.
Yes.
We're just asking to be treated like everybody else.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, so what activities are going on now, Chuck, with you, with Black History in DC? Because I
we did a calendar that lists around 70, 80 events that have been happening throughout the month of February. Of course, we will put together a whole list of activities for Frederick Douglass's bicentennial birthday, because the idea is that this birthday celebration is a year-long celebration, so we don't want to just do February and let things stop. There's
right.
So many other things that we want to do and need to do to celebrate Douglass throughout the year. And then, of course, there is we'll be involved in the observance of Dr. King's assassination, 50th observance, and there'll be all kinds of things that are going to happen during that time. You know, particularly in D.C., what was it like in D.C. when Dr. King was assassinated? He was on his way here for the Poor People's Campaign. And, of course, the riots occurred here. Now, who remember those, and where were you when you found out Dr. King was killed? Where were you when you heard about the riots? You know, and those kinds of things that we need to remind people happen. And talk about those. And then there were just a lot of things that happened 50 years ago that are significant. In turn, even our struggle for statehood. And so we will be looking at all kinds of activities for Douglass, as well as for Dr. King, and as far as the Emancipation Proclamation. So we're planning a number of things. I know that there's going to be a play about Douglass Goes to Ireland. That's going to be at some point a reception, a descendants reception, where we're going to have some of Douglass's family members here at the African-American Civil War Museum, and not only will we have them here, but we'll have other families who in the area who are descendants, because they had people who fought in the Civil War. And so we'll get a chance to recognize the Douglas family, not only their family, but also other descendants who fought in the Civil War. We will do a musical concert called A Musical Odyssey of Frederick Douglass' Life. And then, of course, there is a number of peace groups coming together with all over the country will be coming to D.C. for a march on the Poor People's Campaign. They're going to recreate that for a couple of days. So there's just a number of activities that we will be pushing throughout the year. I think the important thing is that we not get caught in just doing something in January for Dr. King and February for Frederick Douglass and Black History, but there are all kinds of things that we need to remember and celebrate these 50 years that is coming up.
And is there a central location where people can find out about this? Is there a website or something they can go to see what the calendar is?
There is indeed a website. You can also call the African American Civil War Museum. And I don't want to give the wrong webpage out, but if you call there, or you can send me an email at MrBlackHistory@yahoo.com, and I can forward the information to you and have it sent to you.
Great, and we'll also post that when we get it from Chuck. We'll follow up. We'll post it on our website, too,
sure,
so that you'll be able to do that. Yeah. And, well, what do we do moving forward now, Chuck, for Black History? What can we do to enhance it and make sure that kids in school are learning this, kids of all races are learning this?
I think there are a couple of interesting things that are happening. And one, of course, is that there is a movement by the Frederick Douglass Foundation family, and they have printed, or they're trying to distribute a million books this year about the life of Frederick Douglass and trying to put them into children's hands to read all over the country, from small towns like Bogalusa, Louisiana, the schools in Maine, to Missouri, to Iowa, what have you. And that if, when people read the life of Frederick Douglass in children's literature, it's an inspiring story that lets people know that they, too, can be important. That's one of the things. I think the other thing is that it becomes important for us to work together, that we find, we build coalitions. Sometimes coalitions become important because we can set our eyes on one goal that we can work together on. And that's important, that we can't all work on every project and agree, but we can find coalitions on certain projects that we can work together on. One of the things that made us so successful with the Martin Luther King Memorial was that people came together because they believed in many of the things that King stood for. And so you had women rights groups, you had gay groups, you had Democratic Party, you had statehood people, you had educational groups, all coming together because there was something that King stood for that was important to all of us. And by learning to work together and interact, we can grow, we can build coalitions. We also have to be mindful, I think, that we all need to realize and take upon ourselves the concept of adopt this idea that I'm going to do something once a week that's going to make a difference for me, that I feel like I've made a difference in somebody's life. I'm going to be positive about something, and that I'm going to look out and figure out how I can do something. Lots of our young people need support, and sometimes it just means, you know, helping them. It doesn't mean maybe you can get them, refer them and take them to a Boy Scout meeting, or take them to a museum, or work with a church group that might need some volunteers. But I think there's a role for all of us, and I think it means coming together. And I think that we need to think of ourselves as one. You know, we have different issues, but there are some common issues. And one of the things that becomes important is the right to vote.
I think that's important.
When we don't appreciate the right to vote, we see where we are today. And that I think is just absolutely horrific. And I think we all need to figure out a way that we can do two things as collectively. Is that we need to find a way to address mental illness in this country, because it's all over this country, and we never know when or where it's going to strike. Not only in the African American community, or the Latino community, or the Asian community, or the white community. Mental illness is everywhere. And there's nothing more important in terms of trying to find cures and outlets for people who have problems.
Well, that we've just seen that in Florida, haven't we?
Yes, and maybe we all don't agree with the gun issue, and there's some people who are going to have challenges with that. But I don't think that anybody can disagree that we need to have more mental health services throughout this country. And that
that's
if we work towards
true.
That. Now, that's
well,
a goal
Chuck,
that we can all begin.
We have a caller on the line that has a question for you.
Sure.
Tabu, are you there?
I am. Hi, both of you. And thank you both for being on. I really, really enjoyed it thus far. And at first, I'd like to thank both of you for your work that you do in the community. Chuck, how are you?
I'm good, my brother. How are you?
Okay. Well, you know, I was listening to both of you, and I listened to Senator Brown. He mentioned his dad, and I was wondering, Chuck, I know you're very modest. You don't like to take credit for a lot of your great work, but I was wondering, do you want to talk a little bit about your dad and his great work?
Well,
or would you rather not?
I certainly can, you know. My dad was...
Well, if I could say, before you do, I would like to ask the question, who shot Dr. King? Do we talk about that, you know? And from that, the reason I mention that is to let you know why you have to defend yourself. And Chuck, you might want to talk a little bit about your dad on that sense.
Well, I think there's two interesting questions. I think that many of us don't believe the stories that the government put out about how Dr. King, or who shot Dr. King. I think the King family did not accept the report. I think there are many people in the community who still have a problem accepting that report. One of the things I think that my dad was involved in, he was involved with a group called the Deacons. And the Deacons were the first black group in this country to carry guns for self-protection. And the Deacons started in Greensboro, Louisiana, but the first chapter was started in Bogalusa. And it was during a time when they were doing what they call days of testing in the South. And what they did was when you wanted to integrate the Woolworths or the JCPenney's or whatever, you go in and you get some white kids and black kids and workers, and you go in and you ask to be served. And you stay there until they serve you. But one of the things that happened when they were having the days of testing in Bogalusa is that at one point there was a mob of about 300 white men who had formed together to come down and lynch my family, because our family was the family that had decided to keep the white civil rights workers in Bogalusa. It was three of them. So at one point the chief of police said that a mob was coming and they were going to lynch us and burn our house down. And my dad asked for protection. He said, "It's your job to protect us." And the chief of police said, "I don't have time to be fooling with niggers and poor white trash," talking about the poor civil rights workers. He said, "I got 16,000 other citizens to protect." So my dad said, "If you can't get me protection, I'll get my own." And so he asked my sister to start calling his friends, and a lot of these men were deacons. And so the deacons had the first chapter was formed in Bogalusa. And so my sister started calling people, saying, "Quick, call your, tell people that the mob is coming to lynch us, bring your guns and have your wives, call other black families." And so at one point there were probably 75 black people on our roof, on the porches, in people's porches and on trees to protect us. And needless to say, the 300 white men never came down there. But it did hit the news. The New York Times and the Chicago Times, all the major papers and things got it. And when the sun came up, the newspapers were down there, and they saw all these black men with guns, and they asked my dad, "Who are these men. He says, these are the Deacons for Defense and Justice. HBO did a movie called The Deacons for Defense with Forrest Whitaker and Ozzie Davis. And Forrest Whitaker plays my dad in the movie. But I think one of the important things that happened with the Deacons, and if you ever read the history of the Black Panther Party, Huey Newton tells Bobby Seals, we needed a group like the Deacons in Bogalusa. And that's that when they went into Sacramento to the state capitol and had those guns across their chest, because they could carry, they couldn't carry rifles, I mean handguns, openly, but they could carry shotguns. And you see a lot of places in the South, you would see these men riding in the back of their trucks, and they have those rifles on the back. And so the Deacons had a right to carry guns openly, too. And so that's one of the things that happened. But I think one of the important things that happened with the Deacons is that from that, there were chapters that started forming throughout the South. But one of the things that I always say, there were two kinds of Deacons. There were the official group of Deacons who had walkie-talkies and kept track of certain people. Our family was a Mark family. So every place we went for 3 or 4 years, somebody escorted us. But the other thing that the Deacons did was there was an informal group of Deacons. And so if you lived on the street, when all this, you know, white people just had a habit of just driving down in a small town and going through a community and shooting up. And so all of a sudden, when the Deacons got organized, and then all of a sudden, if you lived on the street, you know, and there wasn't any Deacons, you might say, there are 4 or 5 black men on that street. So Mr. Johnny said, I'll tell you what, Jimmy, I'm going to take Tuesday night. And Jimmy said, well, I'll take Wednesday night. And these men would stay up after 11 or 12 o'clock and watch to see if somebody strange drove down the street. And if they did, they shot at them. Or they called people. They flashed a light. They let people know, a flashlight, that somebody's in this neighborhood that shouldn't be. And so all of a sudden, when people started fighting back, when people would shoot back, and there's so many, many cases where it's not reported of how white people drove into a neighborhood and shot and got shot, got ran out because black people started shooting back. They broke that up. That was a social habit. They on Friday nights or Saturday night, let's go pick a nigger. Let's go shoot a nigger. But with the Deacons,
right. Well, you see, Senator Brown, why it's necessary. This is part of Black history. When we talk today about guns in our community, it is part of our history. We have a history of defending ourselves when no one else would. You know, and that's why. Thank you, Chuck. You're doing such a great job. And I want to also point out about Black History Month, National Freedom Day.
Yeah.
I think it started back, I could be wrong on this, but the 13th Amendment was signed, I think, February the 1st, 1865.
Yeah.
And you had Major, what was his name, Woods, who wanted to have National Freedom Day. And when Isaac, the brother, got his eyes put out by the police in Batesburg, South Carolina in 47 or 48, 46, I guess it was, because they had National Freedom Day, I think Truman made it 1948. This was a veteran, Isaac Woodard, who was in uniform, policeman, put his eyes out, both of his eyes out with the baton as in uniform, because he was riding on a bus and he wanted to use the bathroom and asked him, guy could go to the bathroom, and he said something to him, and he said something. He said, well, I'm going to talk back to you the way you talk to me. So when he got to the next city in Batesburg, that's what the police did to us. So I'm saying all that to say we have a history of defending ourselves. We must, and that's why defense is part of our community today. And we must remember that you mentioned also Gandhi. Gandhi was not the father of nonviolence. It was William Whipper. When we in our community, we talk to you little whippersnapper. We talk about William Whipper, you know. So, Chuck, you can finish on if you care to, but I just had to mention that because it's such a key part, and thank you for that. You're doing such a great job, and I just thank both of you.
You know,
I'm going to leave
one
now.
One of the things that, you know, before they began, Carter G. Woodson began Negro History Week, there were times that blacks would meet in places like Chicago and St. Louis and have big conventions and
right.
celebrate for 3 or 4 days, just black people and their contributions to things. So Carter G. Woodson got the idea from the fact that there were black groups, so, educational groups and businesses who would get together every 2 or 3 years and have a big convention, and they would celebrate the contributions of African Americans. And he finally got the idea that we need to nationalize this. But before that, before they had Negro History Week, there were all kinds of black celebrations that were happening throughout this country in major cities and areas by black businessmen and educators. But he just began to pull that concept together in a more organized fashion. And one of the things, of course, is that I think the importance of guns for us in the black community has been one of self-protection. And throughout the South, I think the issue today is that anybody can get a handgun, these automatic weapons and things, and can do all kinds of destruction and vindictiveness because of the challenge of mental illness. The fact that that boy went into that church in North Carolina and killed all those black people. And I mean, this even hate has a mental illness about it. You know, yeah. That you can't hate that way without having been mentally disturbed. It's not just being mad with somebody and losing, you know, something like that. And that's one of the things that becomes crisis intervention with young people, is that you must learn to talk things out. Not get somebody make you mad and you go home and get a gun, or you go find somebody you know got a gun and borrow it so you can shoot somebody. Those are not the answers. There are several things to that. One is, of course, mental illness, and one is we must learn that we need to care about each other, that we're human beings. And that the other piece about remembering violence is that I tell people all the time is that you don't just kill one person. You shoot a guy, but you've hurt and you destroyed two families. First of all, your family has a problem now in the neighborhood because people say, "Oh, that's Miss So and So's son. You know, they should have raised him better." Oh yeah, don't go over there. I don't want you running. You know, her boy shot somebody, and then the person who lost somebody, they have lost somebody that was important to them. And so their family is torn apart because they've lost somebody who was special, and they have to learn to try to relive that. So you shooting somebody, it's not just you taking an action, but it's like a ripple. There are a lot more people affected by your action than just you. And so we need to think about other people that we care about, you know?
Yeah, and that has to be part of the debate.
There are people who, when they've done something hot-headed, they come back and say, I wish I would have waited. I wish I would have thought this out. If they could have waited 20 minutes, they wouldn't have done what they did.
Well, and you know, it's odd. I grew up around guns too, Chuck. I mean, I come from a military family, and there were plenty of guns around when I was a kid, but we never heard about this thing of people walking into schools and murdering children. And this is a new phenomenon, and you're right, it is connected to mental illness, and we have to approach it that way. But unfortunately, Chuck Kicks, we're running out of time here, and usually we play a song at the end of the show. We're not even going to do that because you've been such an amazing guest that we're not going to waste a minute of your time. So please tell us, in the couple of minutes we have left, tell us something that you wanted to say that you haven't gotten to say.
Well, I guess the thing that I want to say is that I think that we need to take this year and make an effort that I am going to do something. I'm going to figure out a niche, do something that I can say will make me feel better, if it's helping a senior citizen, if it's calling my mama that I don't never talk to except once a month. I think I'm going to make a commitment to call her once a week, because there's all kind of plans that you can do that. I think I'm going to volunteer to see if there's a little kid that I can spend a Saturday with once a month and take him to a movie or take him to the museum. All the museums are free. Get a kid and take him to the museum. And then afterwards, go to McDonald's.
Yeah. Well, I don't have time to explain to you. I know this man personally, and I don't have time to tell you what a wonderful guy he is. I think that you've heard that from him being on our show tonight. But Chuck Hicks is just an amazing, amazing man with a heart as big as hearts come.
Because there are so many people that have listened. If I ask people to do things, people believe that what I do is the right kind of thing. You're amazed at the you know, sometimes you never know what an example you can be or who you're setting an example for. And so you need to always watch what you do and how you do it, because you can make a world of difference. People are looking at you every day, and if they see you doing something good, it makes a difference.
Well, Mr. Black History, you're making a difference, and you've made a difference in my life, sir. I've known you for a while, and you're an inspiration to us all. So thank you so much, Chuck, for being on the show. And please come back sometime. We'll have you back sometime.
I will.
Sometime, okay?
We'll do this again very soon.
To talk about. Okay, thank you. And God
bless. Thank you,
America. God bless you.
Statehood now.
We'll see you next week. Okay, folks, thanks so much for listening.
All right.
Thanks, Chuck.
Give the people their right to vote.